So we're on to our second day of the of this retreat, which officially is called Training the Mind in Bodhicitta. And yesterday we did an introduction to the mind training, and we did we looked at point one, 7-point mind training, the training in the preliminaries. I always struggle to say that word, preliminaries. Preliminaries. It's like my tongue sort of gets tied. So, and then today we'll be looking at the point two, which is about bodhicitta, training the mind in bodhicitta. And I've been thinking a bit about how we train our mind in bodhicitta, but first I think we need to unpack that word bodhicitta a bit more, because I just notice when I speak about bodhicitta, which is one of my favorite topics, by the way, that I often drift in and out of understanding what it is about. It's a bit of a bizarre experience to, you're kind of thinking about bodhicitta, and I'm thinking like, what shall I tell you about bodhicitta? But actually, bodhicitta is not something that you can understand by thinking about it. So somehow you need to get hold of that concept and feel in your heart, I guess, what it is about. And for me, bodhicitta is something like a kind of movement in the heart, like a bit like a reaching out. I really like that line in the morning puja we've been doing, which is the heart longing for freedom. And I think if we hear that phrase, the heart longing for freedom, you get that sense in the longing there's some sort of reaching out in the heart. At least that's how I hear it. The heart longing for freedom, you get the reaching out. And the reaching out happens when we meet the world, when we meet life, when we see suffering in the world. That's where you feel that movement in the heart, as it were. I don't know whether that resonates with you, but it's, for me, it is really something that you need to experience in the body even, and it's, you can't sort of understand it by thinking it through, if you see what I mean. And I've been also thinking about it as that we've actually been doing quite a lot of training in bodhicitta already. It's not like we're starting today on the retreat, or we started yesterday. All of us here who've been practicing on this path have been training in bodhicitta. So how have we been training in bodhicitta? We've been training in bodhicitta because we at some point came across the bodhisattva ideal, which is very well represented in our tradition. We do a lot of teachings around bodhisattva ideal. And you know, bodhisattva ideal, again, is quite a conceptual kind of thing, but you get glimpses through the practice of that real strong sense of, I am doing this practice for the benefit of all beings, including myself. And I think I'm not the only one who get glimpses of that, so glimpses of that aspiration to practice for the benefit of all beings. But that doesn't mean that I'm always actually conscious of it or always remembering that that is what I would like to be doing. So people who join the order as one of their ordination vows, we have, I accept this enlightenment, the enlightenment. No way. Yes, exactly. Accept this ordination for the benefit of all beings. Another one is also just that you're accepting it well, because you want to gain enlightenment. So it's, you think it's going to help you for that. So the so we take this vow in one way or another. We have taken this vow in a bigger way or a smaller way many times, and also in the sevenfold puja that we're doing. The last verse, the transference of merits and self-surrender, that is that same expression of doing the practice for the benefit of all beings, and it's incredibly important to do that. It's not about ourselves alone. We're not isolated. We're part of this big fabric of relationships, and everything we're doing, all our practice, is actually rippling out, having a ripple effect on whoever we meet outside of our Buddhist centers outside of our practicing on the cushions. So that bodhicitta is like the attitude of the bodhisattva. You could say that is bodhicitta, the attitude of the bodhisattva. You could also say the awakened heart, or the mind oriented towards enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So you get all these phrases around it. I think you've got to feel your way into it, really. And also something I've been thinking about is in relation to this training, the bodhicitta, and any kind of mind training we've been doing so far, I think it's useful to think about it as a skill, and you can learn it, you have to practice it. That's what I'd like to say. And I think often we just like to just be in this big bath of compassion or have this amazing insight, etc., which is lovely, and it's amazing when it happens, but we need to practice, and so we need to accumulate the skill that comes after a lot of practice. So in that sense, is we're practicing bodhicitta, which is different from the bodhicitta completely manifesting in our being. We're practicing it. I like the practicing the scales. I don't know whether any of you has played the piano at all, but if you're practice or guitar, you're practicing chords or you're practicing your scales, and that is going to eventually result in being able to play a piece of music flawlessly. So I like that, to think about the training in the bodhicitta as a skill. Does that work? Yeah. Few nods.
Absolutely.
Good. A few nods. That's always good. We're on the same page. So moving on to the 7-point mind training. In the 7-point mind training, we're introduced to the absolute bodhicitta you can train in, and you can also train in the relative bodhicitta. So I'll try to unpack that a bit. Well, you could liken it to absolute bodhicitta is like wisdom, and the relative bodhicitta is like compassion. I think that works. That works very well to see it like that. Mm-hmm. And absolute bodhicitta is like a direct insight into the nature of reality. That's, you could say absolute bodhicitta is like that. And it results into that direct insight into the nature of reality results in a more open dimension of being, openness, rather than that kind of contractedness, being tensed up. So it's an open and very open and relaxed mode of being. And you could also say absolute bodhicitta is like resting in a non-discursive state, just completely relaxed. I quite like that image. I think it's used in different contexts, but it works here as well. It's like this sphere on a plane, and the sphere is just, you know, resting there, and it's not being pulled here, there, and everywhere. I know it's an image that we usually use for equanimity, but I think it works for absolute bodhicitta as well. And also it's a state. When we're practicing absolute bodhicitta, we're practicing to be free from conceptual elaborations. So yesterday we already touched upon that. Yesterday afternoon we talked quite a bit about that, didn't we? About the fabrications, about everything we're adding on to the raw sense data. So the teaching of the Buddha, in the seen, only the seen, in the heard, only the heard, that's the teaching that he's giving to Bahia. It's not different in that sense of this absolute bodhicitta. So you just have that reality, and you're not adding anything onto it, basically. Yep. Mm-hmm. So far, so good. And obviously, our biggest teaching about what absolute bodhicitta might be like is the Heart Sutra. It's complete openness. Complete openness of being, absolute bodhicitta. And then with the relative bodhicitta, you're getting more into the aspect of aspiration. So the heart aspiration of practicing for the benefit of all beings, that would be called relative bodhicitta. And the relative bodhicitta, to practice relative bodhicitta, practicing relative bodhicitta, it uses the ordinary mental processes. Mm. You know, it's we're using, for instance, when we're doing the metta bhavana, we're just using ordinary mental processes to do the practice. And then we know we might do it imperfectly, but we're still doing it because we've got this vision of what it is going to lead to, and we've got this aspiration that we're doing the practice for the benefit of other people and including ourselves. But it might not entail this clearly seeing into reality at that particular moment, if you see what I mean, but that might result from it at the end. So The relative bodhicitta is so we're using this ordinary mind to train in love and compassion, and it also entails that we're turning towards suffering rather than shying away, turning away from it. And it's not only the suffering in others, but it's also the suffering in ourselves. So we're kind of getting, we're turning towards it and getting really intimate with it, rather than trying to block it or reject it. Or and so we're doing that both internally and externally. So not turning away from suffering, but just looking it in the face, as it were. So the basic principle of this lojo mind training is that you're always training. You're always training in bodhicitta, whether you're clearly seeing directly what's happening, or whether you've got the aspiration to practice, the aspiration to reach out, the aspiration to love and to benefit all beings. You see what I mean? So another way I've been approaching it in the past, which I think works, is the absolute bodhicitta is like the direct seeing. You could liken it to jnana, so the jnana aspect. And the relative bodhicitta, you could liken it to punya. So punya being merit, and jnana means you know, direct, yes. Direct seeing, direct knowledge of reality. So acts for the benefit of other beings are going to result in positive conditions in the future. I think the exemplification of a bodhicitta is, I referred to that yesterday, is offered by the Buddha, just by his act of going out onto this quest to go deeply into the nature of reality, to really understand what is happening, and he did that because he wanted to benefit all beings. So you could say that is an act of, that is bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. But the bodhicitta is a Mahayana word, so you won't find it as far as I'm aware. It's not a Pali canon kind of thing. It's what comes later in the Mahayana. It comes with the when the bodhisattva ideal is emphasized, the compassion aspect of the practice is emphasized. So that's my introduction. Any questions you need to have answered before we move on? No. Might be, but let's see. So what we'll do is just have another few minutes, and then we'll get into the next bit. Just a few minutes of silence. So I've picked my slogans up. And so these are all the slogans that have to do with point two. There's nine of them. And the first five are about absolute bodhicitta. And we'll get to the other ones after the break, because the other ones all pertain to relative bodhicitta, which is also to do with the practicing of the Tonglen meditation. So the absolute bodhicitta, the first slogan, it's regard all dharmas as dreams. So that's the first slogan in this sequence. Regard all dharmas as dreams. And we talked a bit about that yesterday, didn't we? We talked about fabrication yesterday. We talked about that mismatch between what's actually happening and what we think is happening, and all the kind of interpretations and the hopes and expectations we lay onto something that happens. We had quite a few good examples as well in the group yesterday. But regarding all dharmas as dreams is that... experience may seem solid. So that's the thing, isn't it? We interpret something and we think this is true, this is how it is, and we act on the basis of that. Mm-hmm. And then we're actually acting on the basis of something that is illusory. And all of these thoughts are going to pass at some point, you know. They're never going to linger. Any emotion, any experience, any thought, anything that comes up in experience is going to pass through. It's not going to linger. That's such is the nature of thought. And I know that on retreats I've been on, certainly, at some point you always get this moment that people are kind of sitting like they're looking like bewildered, and they're kind of clutching the table and they're saying, this is, are you telling me this isn't real? Well, the thing is, yes, it is real, of course. Our experience is real. There's no denying it because we're experiencing it. So whatever we're, you know, it's not like Paul is not sitting there, or I'm not sitting here, or there's no floor. It's there, yeah? It's there. We're experiencing it. I'm experiencing solidity. I get sense impressions, etc., etc. But the thing is, all of that doesn't exist in the way I think it exists. That's the whole crux. So do not think that there isn't anything. That's the nihilist trap, isn't it? That's nihilism that we're falling into. There is nothing there, and it's all blah, blah, blah. There is something. There is definitely something there. But it's just different from how we think it is. That's what it comes down to. So obviously we've got a really good tool for that in that we're using quite a lot, is the tool that we know from Buddhism, that everything is impermanent. So in that sense, things aren't solid, and we think they're solid, but they're not solid. And even if I think the chair I bought is solid, I can still see, you know, next year I see it and see, oh, it's really gone yellow, or something has happened. It is changing. It's just changing in a different kind of time trajectory, as it were. And then always you get this example of somebody saying, oh, yeah, you can burn it and it becomes wood, or, you know. Or if for an ant, it's like a mountain. There's all sorts of ways that you can look at these objects and all sorts of approaches you can take, that you can convince yourself, no, actually, I see this thing in a particular way, mm. but actually there's something different the matter here. And when I did this material last, I remembered we just had an open day at our center, and there was a woman who was talking about how, as a student, she went to his art class. And so they had this object in the middle of the room, and people were just painting a still life. So you had all these easels around it. So a bit like how we're sitting here in this space, really. So you're looking at something, and obviously on everybody's canvas appears something different, because they're looking at it from a different angle. And I thought that was quite a good example of that there is no intrinsic quality to the being of whatever they were painting, if you see what I mean, because it can always be seen from all these different angles. And I think another experience I've had with this, I'm sure you must have had your experiences, just that things are not as solid as you think they are, is that I was on a retreat and I saw this hedge, and actually it was a retreat on the transcendental principle. And rather than seeing a hedge, I remember I can't remember seeing it before that moment, that this was not a hedge, but this consisted of different scrubs, different trees, different leaves, different branches. So all of that together you can label hedge, but what's actually going on beneath that label is something that's incredibly complex. So in that sense also, things aren't solid, thoughts aren't solid. And let me see what else I've got here. Well, the approach I mentioned yesterday is also a really good approach. The skandhas, just reflecting, contemplating the skandhas, is another model that you can get into. The nature of experience isn't solid. You can always unravel it, unpick it, and it becomes something completely different. There is nothing solid about it, nothing at all solid about it. And yet we attribute that idea that is solid to it. So we're not convinced that it is illusory. So, and that is the problem. We need to be convinced that our perception is illusory. So, yes, experience happens. Yes, concepts are incredibly important. It's incredibly important if Amala is asking me, shall I switch the light on? That I understand that she means that, a switch is going on, there's light coming. We need concepts. We need concepts to exist with each other and to communicate. But yet, we need to hold them very lightly and not see them as solid. And that is the exercise that needs to be made. Being convinced that the world you perceive is constructed, is fabricated.
Don't we need to see that ourselves are the same? We ourselves are all also constructed in an illusory in some way. In order to see that other things are as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So we're now, the examples I'm giving now is about like perceiving things outside, but this actually completely pertains to everything that comes up in mind. And actually what I've been talking about is about perception. So it's all about what is happening in your own experience. So in that sense, it's an incredibly complex fabrication, because it's everything woven together. It's like views and memories and inclinations and aspirations, and it's all completely woven together. So it's very convincing. The world is very convincing from that perspective, both internally and externally. It's just completely, you just think it's real, but it's constructed. An image that came up for me as well about the illusory nature of our experience, basically, of how we interpret the world, is: have you ever seen a dog dreaming? Have you seen that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you see they're lying there, and their bodies are moving because they've got some sort of dream happening. I don't know. So their bodies are completely responding to what's happening. I don't know what's happening there, but in the same way, that's happening to us constantly. So we got these streams of thoughts and ideas and interpretations going through the experience. And maybe sometimes, you're even responding physically. You might kind of, you've got a thought and you go like, or you see what I mean? You're responding to it. Mm-hmm. All the time to the stream of illusory stuff that's going through. And sometimes I think most often you're not responding in terms of a body, a visible body response, reaction, but you're responding by, the body's still responding, but you're not seeing it. It's like things are tensing up, like muscles are tensing up. I'm thinking about such and such was unkind to me, and then I get this kind of, you know, tensing up in the heart area, or I get, you get a lot of tension often in the legs for this, that and the other. So it, you see what I mean? So you get the muscles responding to these thoughts, and they're completely, it's just a fabrication, yeah? Which is quite interesting, isn't it? So the idea to be free from that would be to not have that tension in the muscles or in the body, or it would be, it just be relaxed. I find that myself quite an interesting practice, to go to the tension and get more, get into it, really get into it, start relating to it, and knowing there is something kind of contracting here. It's not openness. So what's happening here? So thoughts, all our experience thoughts are dreamlike. That's what this slogan is telling us. All dharmas, dharma mean, just means mind object, basically. All mind objects are dreams. Clear, isn't it? It's a bit like bubbles in a stream. So there is a lot of practice that you can do to start to relate to thoughts as if they're like bubbles in a stream, as it were. I'll just give you one story which for me really showed me that process of fabrication that is happening. And I was on this retreat, it was a Buddhafield retreat, and sitting in a tent, and I was going quite deeply in meditation. I had sort of was quite absorbed in meditation, and I had this sensation on my hand which was incredibly pleasurable. It's just, you know, how you're going to get into this real strong sort of experience of pleasure in the meditation. So I was getting that, and so I was really going, really sort of concentrating on that. And then at some point I felt this sort of like, I felt something on the skin, and it turned, and I thought, oh, and then I opened my eyes, and it turned out there is a slug on my hand. And then so I saw this slug, and I went, you know, I completely went, and in a state of shock, I've got this slug on my hand, and you know, And this idea of a slug is like the most revolting, horrible being that can be on my hand. So that, and but the thing is, we're in the middle of the meditation. We've got 10 minutes left in the meditation. I can't just get up. I thought I didn't want to disturb people by getting up and trying to get rid of my slug. So 10 minutes of the was remaining in the meditation, I was sitting there with that slug on my hand, just being really aware of the sensations. And the concept being slugs are horrible, but the sensations were telling me, actually, this is lovely to have this this contact with the slug. It just, and it really showed me that the power of those mental constructs, yeah? So this idea that slug is horrible.
The only mistake you made was opening your eyes.
Yes. But then I did feel his sort of, what do you call it, tentacle, or his, what do you call
antennae.
It?
Antennae.
His antennae. I did feel them, so it was hard, you know, to not see what's happening, look what's happening. So, it is really important that, well, not to fall into the trap of nihilism, but still being convinced that this is a construct, I'm dreaming and I need to wake up. Yeah, that's the important bit. So what I thought we could do now, we'll just do a 5 minute period on our seats in meditation posture, and So I invite you to look at your thoughts, if you can see them. Look at whatever's happening. Look at your thoughts. Find your thoughts and look at them and see, are these solid? Are they not solid? Let's have a good look. So, regard all dharmas as dreams. So just, this practice normally does take, you do need to have a fair amount of concentration. So if it doesn't work, don't worry. You could just always try it later when you feel a bit more spacious and concentrated, less discursive maybe. But just for now, it's always like if you're waiting for a thought to come up, none will come up, but some will come up. At some point a thought will come up, I assure you. Whenever a thought comes up, clearly looking and asking, is this solid? So the slogan about regarding all dharmas as dreams, which is actually, it's a meditation instruction. So you can do this in the meditation regularly, just maybe do a few minutes or do 10 minutes. Best works best if you feel positive, if you feel resourced, if you feel fairly concentrated and spacious, that's the best conditions to look into this. So these are meditation instructions to start looking into the absolute bodhicitta, the nature of reality. So regard all dharmas as dreams, and you might kind of not get into a continuous like seeing that everything, that all the thoughts are ephemeral, not solid, don't have any kind of edges to them, they just go. So, but any, you know, if you do start to see this more clearly, you could imagine what the liberation is, the liberation of compulsive behavior, of obsession. So it's a real strong practice, and I recommend trying it at home or later on the retreat. So this is going into the big pot now, to be offered later. So our next slogan, yeah, we can cook a nice soup.
This is the magical brew.
Yes, the magical brew, the witch's kettle, whichever you want. So some of these slogans sound very enigmatic, I must say, but so they all probably need a bit of unpacking, most of them. So the next one is called Examine the Nature of Unborn Awareness. Examine the Nature of Unborn Awareness. So we've been looking at thought just now. And these are Mahamudra types of inquiry. You can examine the nature of unborn awareness. Look into the nature of mind. That is the first port of call, as it were. So just looking directly at what is going on there in experience. So we've been looking at thoughts, but where are these thoughts happening?
Yeah.
Where do they start? Where do they finish? Do they have a location? Is there a color or smell? Is there texture to them? What is this space that... Is it a space where thoughts come up? What is it that is perceiving the thoughts? So there's all these questions, or it's an inquiry into the nature of reality that we could go into, and one of the strongest inquiries you can do around the nature of reality is probably the one of trying to find anybody who is noticing something, anybody who's observing something, anybody who's watching, anybody who is thinking. So this is the, according to the Buddha, according to Buddhism, the basic mistake that we're making. A thought comes up, and then we're assuming there must be somebody thinking this thought. So you're kind of fabricating this subject to an object, if you see what I mean. There is a subject, therefore there must be an object, and vice versa. So if you go more deeply into the nature of mind, you might also find that all these thoughts about this is me, or this is not me, this is what I usually do, this is what I never do, this is blah, blah, all these thoughts of identification, they're actually just thoughts. They're just only thoughts, and the thinker is also a disguised thought. I quite like that.
Could you repeat that?
The thinker is a disguised thought. So if you're really noticing thoughts coming up and then being illusory, you could also notice that these thoughts about me and what I am, and there is a me, and where is the me, and it's all thoughts. It's all thoughts. It's nothing but thoughts, yeah? So seriously, I sometimes kind of wonder, like, how can people actually believe this thing about there being some sort of self? I mean, but then I think that about God as well. I mean, it's like it's a sort of imaginary being in the sky with a big beard, you know. So where is that self? Where does it live? Does it live in your head? Does it live in your feet? Does it live in some sort of like control room somewhere? So you see, it is sort of so obvious that there isn't a self. It's just a thought. So examine the nature of unborn awareness, and the addition here of unborn awareness, it's that if you look in the nature of mind, if you look at the nature of mind, there isn't a beginning, there isn't an end, there isn't any edges, it doesn't start anywhere, it doesn't finish anywhere, that is what is meant by the unborn, isn't born, nothing is born, nothing dies in the nature of reality. So, that
so
is...
if we're looking for unborn awareness, we won't find it.
No. You know, you can't find any born awareness either.
Well, I understand, but that's kind of the point.
Yeah. It is actually a statement. It's a statement.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness isn't born. It isn't... anyway. It's a statement. So, this is actually also a meditation instruction. Let me see if I've got anything. Yeah, so that's all I've got to say about this one. But I think what we do is just try this out for 5 minutes, a little taster session of this. And then again, it's a meditation instruction. So you can apply this in a meditation when you feel you've got enough resources, spaciousness, etc. Feel positive enough. So just do 5 minutes again of this. Examine the nature of unborn awareness. So rather than looking for any thoughts, if you can at all, direct your attention to where is this coming up, what is happening here, what is the nature of this experience, what is its texture, where is it? You find an edge, color, what is the nature of this awareness? Where is the mind? Yes, it's also a bit like you can liken it to, you know, a thought comes up and you're getting really interested in it, but then it's a bit like looking in the mirror and only seeing your face, but there is also a space around it, as it were. And usually we're not really paying attention to the space in which, if there is such a space, in which the thoughts sort of arise. So we're only looking at or getting completely sort of immersed or obsessed even with the content of the thoughts. But there's also, there's so much more to it that's happening in experience. Anyway, so, and again, this is a meditation instruction, and you can do this a few minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, whenever you feel you'd like to have a good look. Go ahead. It's disappearing in the pot now. So I'm moving on to the third slogan in this point, which is self-liberate even the antidote. Self-liberate even the antidote. And I was thinking this morning that I mentioned this book that I was reading about unlearning meditation. It really, you know, it really works with this slogan, the content of that book. So sometimes you just got to let go of the instructions. You got to let go and of the instructions and experience directly. So self-liberate even the antidote is like we're sitting here looking at the nature of thoughts, or looking at, okay, there's a thought, it's not solid, and we're having to tell ourselves that. We're having to tell ourselves, like, oh, there is, where is the edge, where is the, we're doing this inquiry, we're giving ourselves these instructions to look at the experience. And self-liberate even the antidote, it is actually just directly seeing it as it is, and not needing the construct, not needing the concept that's pointing to it. So that you let go of. Yeah, simple. It is self-liberating. It says self-liberate, so it's not like something that needs to be forced or.
You don't have to do that.
No, in terms of the sequence of these this inquiry, it's getting into more and more relaxed state. So more and more being aware that of the adding on to the raw sense data, you know, the interpretation, the expectations, everything that's piled onto it. So if you're getting more of a idea this is fabricated, somehow there's delusion going on, and you can clearly see that, that kind of relaxes the compulsory nature of having to follow it up, having to do something with it. So that drops away, and then this idea that there is somebody thinking the thoughts sort of drops away, and then you get this sort of, you get into a much more relaxed, spacious awareness. And then self-liberate even the antidote, you're just getting more into a space where you don't need to have those instructions going on, because you're seeing it directly, because you trained yourself in seeing it directly. Yeah. So I'm going to put this in a pot.
Are these intended to be practiced sequentially?
No, I don't think so. Not necessarily, but it is. I mean, it's layered. Yeah. So in that sense, yes, sequentially. I think it makes most sense to start with the thoughts and being getting really good at it, and then move to the next level. So in that sense, yes. Yes, but I think you could also use them as standalone practices, because you'll get something out of it. Whichever you're trying out, if you see what I mean. Does that answer your question?
Sure.
Okay. Shall I go put it in a pot then? Once it's in the pot, it can't come back, yeah? There it goes.
It's been self-liberated.
It's been self-liberated in pot. So we're going to go to the next one, which is rest in the nature of Alia, the essence. Rest in the nature of Alia, the essence. And I'm not sure whether everybody knows what Alia is. Okay. Good. Alia comes from as far as I know, it's the model of eight consciousnesses, and it comes from the Tibetan Buddhism, it comes from Mahayana Buddhism. I know it from Yogacara. I don't know whether it's also outside of the Yogacara tradition, but Alia is, so you get the six sense consciousnesses, and you get a consciousness that is the consciousness that divides the world up in like me and mine, no to that, yes to that, so the kind of ego clinging kind of consciousness, so that's the seventh, and then the eighth is some sort of storehouse consciousness. So it's every experience is coming out of some sort of subconscious kind of storehouse kind of thing. It is not anywhere, but it's some sort of model, it's some sort of explanation as to how consciousness works. So you get these different aspects, right? So the model, how it works in terms of the practice is that I quite like this actually. So in terms of the practice, you're putting virtuous and insight seeds into the big pot. This is a good into the big pot, and something will come out of it. Something will kind of come up in consciousness, and that comes out of the alia. That's the idea. It's a storehouse consciousness, and I think that's all I can say about it right now. Because what the slogan points to is, I've been talking about getting into more relaxed states. So in terms of the meditation, it would be a meditation where you literally just rest in experience. So you're not chasing anything up, you're not following anything up, not needing to have any explanations, it's quiet. There's hardly any thoughts, and it's just, you're just resting in awareness, basically. So that is meant by resting in the nature of alia. Mm. It might sound, I don't know whether it sounds like something really difficult, but I think we all got moments like that in our lives, that somehow there is that spacious resting. It might be glimpse, you know, it might last a few minutes, it might just be literally a glimpse, it might last an hour, but that kind of state where there's no proliferation, just being with what is.
But isn't this store consciousness, well, language is terrible here. But
that's fine.
Isn't it the sort of place of consciousness that proliferation comes out of?
Yeah. But yeah, that's true too. But then,
but
you could
so it, with this, we're sort of resting in it, in its unactive. So maybe it's more like that experience of total open potential or something.
Yeah, but you could also say if something like the beginnings of proliferation comes up, it just comes up and it goes again.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So that's also a meditation. Highly recommended. Rest in the nature of alia, the essence. So that's our final meditation instruction for this this first part. Goes into the pot for later. And then the very final instruction is a post-meditation instruction. So this point is made up of meditation instructions and post-meditation instructions. So all of this point to is meditation instructions, basically. And the post-meditation instruction for the absolute bodhicitta is, in post-meditation, be a child of illusion. In post-meditation, be a child of illusion. And We're not only practicing in a meditation, we know that. So we're encouraged, this slogan is encouraging us to also not only see thoughts as illusory or without any substance, as thoughts as empty basically, not only in a meditation, but also outside of the meditation. So be aware that all of this is going on outside of the meditation and try to wake up from it. The child of illusion, I think it's Chögyam Trungpa's language, that's a bit poetic, but it just means like in post-meditation you just still see that it's fabricated and dreamlike. That's the post-meditation slogan.
It sounds very pleasurable and inviting.
Yes, great. Yes, it is, isn't it?
Mm.
I always, do you know this poet, Ryokan, the Japanese Ryokan? So, yeah, he's a Buddhist poet and hermit. And I think of his poems when I read that phrase, a child of illusion, because he's quite sort of childlike. And the play of children is a quality, a bodhisattva quality, that lightness of approach, the innocence as well. There is some innocence there as well, isn't there? And I also remembered in one of his poems where he says, oh, I wish my robe was big enough to what was it again? You have to find that for the puja. I wish my robe was big enough to contain all the suffering in the world. And that's another expression of bodhicitta, I find. So that's our absolute bodhicitta in the pot, all in the pot. And we shall have a break now. Yep. Mm.
Children of illusion.
Yay.